Labor and Commerce will come to orders, 3/24th on the 18th, must be, 18th of March. We have one item on the agenda. Before I get to that, we have Representative Lynn, Representative Book, Representative Holmes, Representative
Newman.
Mark Newman, myself, Chair Olson. I've invited several of our other members to sit at the table. I don't think you have a committee that hears this bill, do you? Did this once before and it worked out pretty good. I believe, I don't know if you do or not. And we have Wes Keller joining us, Representative Keller, who does not have a committee that hears this bill, and he'll be with us shortly. I would encourage anybody who has a BlackBerry to turn it off until the end of the meeting. I don't know what we're doing for treats. I think it's bagels and smoked salmon, isn't it?
Ooh, yummy.
Again, the only item on the agenda today is House Bill 30. We'll be taking no public testimony today. We'll be taking public testimony on Monday. I'd like to invite the co-chairs, Representative Harris and Representative Munoz. I think we can squeeze another chair in there. And
here, Kathy, you sit in the rolling chair. Hold on. Let me see. I got a hearing anyway, so. You got a hearing aid problem?
And welcome to Labor and Commerce. I believe it's the first time this year for both of you. Definitely the first time for you.
It is.
Thank you. Haven't seen that other guy here lately.
All right, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the record. I'm John Harris, representative from District 12, and one of the co-sponsors of the bill. Representative Munoz, to my left, will give you most of the details. I'm going to give you the very brief overview, and Representative Munoz and her staff have been doing an awful lot of work on this bill. So I'm going to hit you off right off the top with some of the hard-hitting stuff, and then she can soften it up. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 30 deals with the subject matter of the defined contribution versus defined benefit in the retirement system for state employees, municipal employees, others that are on that system. As you know, Mr. Chairman, a number of years ago, and for the life of the state up until that point, state employees were on a defined benefit program. You and I and every member of the legislature has been on some sort of a defined benefit program since the beginning of the state. And today, since the legislature took action a few years ago to change over to a Tier 4 defined contribution plan, all new legislators, all new state employees, all that sort of thing, municipal employees are on a defined contribution plan now. Certainly the times that were involved, at the time, the things that were involved caused the legislature and the state to look closely at its retirement system, at its pension plans, at the whole nine yards, and there was a lot of debate. A lot of pressure all the way around, and the legislature ended up voting in support of a different retirement system, mainly due to the fact that they felt like the debt that was owed in the system would not be able to be repaid under the old system, that we were incurring too much. We had other variety of other reasons. Some of the people sitting around this table here actually did a lot more work on the bill than I ever did.
And actually most of us voted for it, as I recall.
Yeah, most of us did.
I didn't.
Including myself, as a matter of fact. And so doesn't mean we can't change our opinion or how we vote, but that's the past, and today we have to look at, and that's the reason we have to look at the future, and that's the reason I bring this bill forward. A couple of reasons I bring it forward to, and others do as well, is to look and to get the dialogue going. I'm not an expert on it, don't claim to be, and there will be people who have the numbers, but in the campaign for governor a few years ago, the governor of Alaska, now Governor Palin, made some very strong statements in her campaign that she felt it was unfair, that the defined contribution plan was bad, and I think some of the words she used were atrocious or something. And so it's my understanding that the governor has some interest in this piece of legislation and this defined benefit plan. And so we're hoping to get the administration to, within the next couple of years anyway, within the next two-year cycle, to get more involved in the process. I don't have any delusions of grandeur that this bill is going to immediately pass and become law in the next 6 weeks or whatever we have left in this session. But I do want, along with those other sponsors of the bill and the co-sponsors, to get the dialogue going. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity that you've given us to have a hearing and to hopefully have a good, honest dialogue about what system is best for the state, what system is best for the state employees, all of which have to be considered. It's a big issue. I think it is a big issue about recruitment and retainment of employees. That there are people who will discuss that much more in depth than I ever will. And, you know, we don't know the effects, I guess, at this point in time completely. I think you'll find that the Troopers Union and maybe some other unions will come forward and talk about, and maybe even trooper management may come forward and talk about how difficult it's been under certain conditions and what some of those conditions may be, part of which may be the retirement system and maybe the benefit system. So, Mr. Chairman, I hope that this committee and the legislature will give this serious consideration. We will work through the issues. I know Representative Seaton doesn't sit on this committee, but was intimately involved with the details of defined contribution versus defined benefit in the past. Certainly has lots of information as well, and I appreciate all of you being here and others. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn it over to the Right Honorable Representative Kathy Munoz, and I'm going to get out of the seat because I think her staff is the one to come up here, and they have lots of information. They've been doing a lot of research and have been working very closely with both the administration and with the different departments and unions and whatever. So thank you very much. And Kathy,
Representative Newman has a question for you before you leave the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Harris, I want to let you off too easy. I know you like to sit up there and answer all the questions you can. You said that Governor Palin had talked about this in her campaign. Have you talked to them? Have you personally talked to her or the administration about where they're at, suggestions to this at all since then?
We have actually, our office has made overtures, and I think Representative Munoz has as well. We have made overtures to various different departments, including the Commissioner of Administration. The Commissioner of Administration has been less than accepting of this. I don't think that the Commissioner is real excited about it, although I think the official position of the Department of Administration has been we're going to look at it and see. But looking at it and seeing there have been some looking at it, but I mean seeing, they don't seem to see too much at this point. So, you know, maybe when they come up and talk, maybe they will say something different. I'm sure that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, you'll all have them up here and give their version of things. But
actually, I believe we have them out in the hallway.
Yeah, they probably didn't want me blasting them, so they stay out of. But no, we've attempted to get the governor involved. We've attempted to get the administration, the commissioners involved in various different departments. I can tell you there are people within the administration, confidentially, will tell you they're very supportive of it, but they can't say too much on the record, you know, out of concern for what their bosses may say and whatever. So that's and so you just have to leave it at that because you have to respect their positions. So, that's the best answer I can give you, and I'll stick to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions for Representative Harris before you got off light?
I'll still be around. You know where my office is. So thank you very much.
Again.
Now I turn it over to Representative Munoz.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. First of all, we invited Ilana.
Can you have your staff identify yourself for the record,
please? I'm sorry.
Please.
I'm both Kathy Munoz, Representative for District 4 here in Juneau, and Kendra Kloster, my staff person, also from Juneau. Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. Before we get started, I'd like to bring to your attention that Ilana Beauvais is available online. I believe she called in.
She's online.
Yes. She is. Okay. Yeah. And I just want to be mindful that she is calling from Washington, D.C., and it's the end of the day in D.C., so as soon as we finish our testimony, if we could give her an opportunity.
We would be delighted to give her as much time as she needs.
Thank you very much.
Within reason.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to bring this issue forward. House Bill 30 is prime sponsored by Representatives Mike Hawker, John Harris, and myself, and is co-sponsored by Representatives Bob Herron, Beth Kurtula, Nancy Dahlstrom, Bob Lynn, Les Guerra, and David Guttenberg. House Bill 30 does three things. It returns the retirement system to a defined benefit system. Two, it provides a date certain, a time certain for current DC employees, defined contribution employees, to opt into the new system. And third, it preserves the Alaska Retirement Management Board, which was a result of SB 141 when the PERS and TERS boards were dissolved. The Alaska ARM Board was established. The process that led to the adoption of SB 141 and the new retirement system was incomplete. Conflicting information made it difficult to make a good decision, and there was a lot of pressure to get the job done. And I'm sure if I had been in the legislature at that time, I would have had no better information insight in coming to a decision. So I do appreciate all of the individuals that were involved in that process. It was a very difficult time and a difficult decision. The issue, though, is not going away. Until we are able to effectively respond to the desires of our constituencies, it will continue to be a litmus test for future candidates of the state legislature. And meanwhile, the defined contribution cohort will continue to grow. At all levels of government, our teachers, police officers, and firefighters are asking us to change the system, that they are not happy with the current system. And every day we depend on these public servants for a high quality of life that we Alaskans enjoy. 73,000 Alaskans are members of the PERS and TERS systems, and 11,600 are enrolled in the new DC system. Many of my constituents are members of these systems, retirement systems, and I have heard dozens of their stories. I have heard stories from young teachers who share with me their 401k reports, and the very depressing results that those reports are showing. And when they sit down to extrapolate what they might earn at the time of their retirement, they are very uncertain about the future. Without Social Security benefits, government workers face a very uncertain future. It is these stories from teachers and others that motivate me to work to restore a reliable pension system. In 2005, it was the unfunded liability that led to the change in the retirement system and rising retirement costs across the country. The unfunded liability, though, is not a function of whether we are in a defined benefit or a defined contribution system. The unfunded liability is the result of not making adequate investments into the retirement plan. And during the 1990s, gross miscalculations were made in funding that system. And over time, as a result, the liability has escalated. One far-reaching aspect of SB 141 that may not have been evaluated came to light only after the bill was signed into law. At two different ARM board meetings, the longtime investment consultant told the board that since the defined benefit plans were essentially closed, very soon the rate of return assumption will need to be reduced as the asset allocation investments need to be geared toward more liquidity and less toward volatility. A lower rate of return on investments will impact the unfunded liability, and this is a result of a defined contribution system. It should also be noted that the debate on SB 141 focused on the higher costs of the Tier 1 plan. And we need to remember, though, that it was the tier, the system had changed to a tier three plan well before 2005. I want to bring to your attention the case of West Virginia because it's very similar to what has happened in Alaska. Due to an unfunded liability of approximately $5 billion, West Virginia closed the defined benefit plan for new DC employees, for new employees in 1991 and changed to defined contribution system. And like Alaska, the supporters of this change said that this will help our unfunded liability. 12 years later, in 2003, the unfunded liability continued to grow and 70% of the retirees had insufficient retirement funds. By 2007, the average annual returns for teachers in this plan trailed similar DB plans by 69%. In closing, the greatest advantage of a defined benefit system is the opportunity to pool risk. By pooling risk, investments into the retirement system can be calculated in a way that assures that all retirees receive a pension, a monthly pension. Retirees do not know how long life will be. Some will live to late 60s, some 70s, and some into their 90s. This is the beauty of a defined benefit system. Employees do not have to save as if they are going to live to be 100 years old. The risk is pooled amongst all retirees, and new hires provide the best source of cash flow for a defined benefit plan. I want to repeat that. New hirees provide the best source of cash flow for a defined benefit plan. My commitment to this issue is based on a commitment that I have made to my constituents. This is the issue that was most often raised when I was a candidate for state legislature. After hearing many personal accounts, I am convinced that it is the right thing to do. I appreciate your consideration, and again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And I would like, if I can, to provide an opportunity for Alana Beauvais to speak. She is a policy analyst with the National Institute on Retirement and Security. And Kendra Kloster will go through the sectional analysis of the bill. And also we have a memo from Buck Consultants that will compare costs, percentage costs between the two plans. And also Jesse Keel from the Juneau Senate office is here. And Jesse has been working with this issue for several years. So I think it would be useful.
Typically, we don't bring people in from the other body to testify on bills.
Okay, that's fine.
But he's welcome to sit here for the rest of the meeting.
Okay. All righty.
We can, Representative Newman.
Chair, are we allowed to talk to the sponsor of the bill here?
Certainly.
First? Sure,
yeah.
Then we'll go to Alana after.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Munoz, I was here when we went through this discussion, and it was a long, hard, bloody fight.
A lot of
very good points on both sides of the issue, and like a lot of the things that we discuss in the legislature, there's a lot of good points on both sides of the issue, and it was a very difficult decision that was made on here. But the bottom line was, speaking for myself, was that we were facing an $8 to $10 billion liability at the time, expected to grow to $16 billion by the time it was completed. Something had to change. The catchphrase at the time was we had to stop the bleeding. We all bled, but we tried to stop the bleeding in the retirement system, no matter what side of the issue you were on. Representative Harris was a speaker at the time. Tough situation for that guy, but he did a good job. One of the problems that was my understanding was the fact that there was, when the stock market crashed, when you have guaranteed benefits going out at 8% a year or whatever the case may be, and you're not making that much money, but the state's on the hook to make sure that you keep paying that out. I don't know anybody in the private sector who's ever had that. That was a difficult situation. I mean, nobody had that guarantee, I don't think. That was the contract at the time. The state negotiated into that agreement. You know, that we seem to be a little bit more flush with money, I think, when that came about. And so consequently, it's been reduced from Tier 1 to Tier 2 to Tier 3 and eventually to Tier 4. So what, in your opinion, should the state guarantee an increase in benefits every year?
I believe the state should invest in an honest analysis between the Tier 3 plan and the defined contribution plan. And until we actually see that analysis, I think it's very hard to really rely on the information and the information that was before the legislature at the time the decision was made.
I mean,
Thank you.
We had a lot of analyses. We spent a month here in special session on this issue. And we had lots of different analyses on this. And I'm going to go back to an issue that, you know, is very similar to this, is we looked at teacher salaries and how we should fund different areas of the state in the student funding formula. And one of the things that we do there in cost differentials is look at different areas. And ICER did a study, the University of Alaska did a study, that said salaries and benefits was the number five reason why teachers didn't, you know, maybe stay in some rural communities. Wasn't their number one reason. Obviously, everybody's benefits and how much they make is important to everybody. But it wasn't the highest thing on it. It was quality of life, other areas like that.
Mm-hmm.
When I hear the discussion on defined benefits and contributions, what often is brought up is the fact that the state can't attract people because of the retirement system. That's the number one reason why we can't attract people. I don't necessarily agree with that, because when I look at other studies with similar issues, that wasn't the number one reason.
Mm-hmm.
When it came to school, the student funding formula was number five reason. What comments do you have on that?
Well, I know anecdotally what I hear from the various departments. For instance, recently I had a conversation with an engineer with the Department of Transportation, and his remark to me was that given the salary levels and the retirement system as a package, it wasn't enough to attract or to be able to fill a number of really critical positions that had been left open for many years. And I hear those examples in other aspects of state government. It's early. I mean, really, it was implemented in 2005, and I mean, the legislation passed in 2005. So we only have 3 years with this new system. So that whole issue of retention and attracting employees is one that, I mean, it's difficult to really have a good grasp on that. But I do know that in talking to a number of different departments that there is a difficulty in filling certain state jobs.
Again, follow up.
Thank
you. And Representative, I'm glad that you brought that issue up, because something that I've looked at in the past is the retire rehire program in the state. And to me, it seemed to be not what I consider a good policy of building a bench, making sure that you have lower level people and keep them moving them up. Moving up the system, because what they did is they would take people who retired on Friday, and on Monday they'd be sitting at the same desk doing the same job with a different title, but they still did the same job. But those people weren't paying into the retirement system anymore, so now we have a multiple problem. Is we've got still the same amount of, or not, actually more, or if you were to take her at flush level, the same amount of people who are state employees, but less people paying into the system, putting a larger burden on the system.
Mm-hmm.
Is that appropriate?
Well, the defined benefit system now is closed plans. And by not having new enrollees contributing to that defined benefit system, but a different mechanism, it as I said in my notes, it leads to actually the unfunded liability growing because the rate of return on the investments of the retirement plan investments, the expected rate of return is reduced. Currently, it's at about 8.25%. If you look over the last 10 or 20 years, the expected return will go down because the board is going to be compelled to invest in more stable, more liquid investments, and that will have an effect. And I think that will add to the unfunded liability. So I don't know if that was directly where you wanted me to go with that question, but I think that is truly a problem with the current system.
So, I guess that you think that a retired person coming back into the system, did you just say that you feel that may be a problem?
I'm sorry, I was talking to the potential of the problem of not having new enrollees paying into your closed plans. Or because, you know, not paying into the defined benefit because now they're closed and the effect that has. But your question had to do more with retirees being hired back. And could you please restate the question? Because I think I got off on a different track.
Well, when they come back in, they get a paycheck, but they're not paying back into the retirement system.
I guess I would have to get back to you on that question.
Yeah. And just one more question, if I will, and I'll let it on. It's interesting, a lot of, again, suggestion that I hear on this defined contributions is that if we go back to the Tier 3 system, that there's an automatic implication that you have money going into your retirement system for one way or another. I try and base it on, you know, is a person will bring something different to the table. And is my wife is a union employee. Currently, the system that she works under, United Food Workers, they're receiving no money into their retirement system right now. She goes to work every day. She gets a paycheck, but there's no money going into her retirement system. She's a union employee. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't mean that, you know, that's an automatic.
That's true.
So could you explain how that works?
Well, I could tell you that the defined contribution plans compared to the defined benefit plans, I mean, certainly the defined benefit plan in this market has also lost steam, so to speak, but not as much as the defined contribution plan. I think the loss was in the 20-plus range, 20-plus percent, and for the defined contribution, it's more in the 30-plus percent range. So, you know, this is a difficult time, obviously, financially. We're experiencing changes in the world markets that we've never experienced, or at least not in my lifetime. So there are challenges, you're correct.
And definitely, yes. Thank you, Mr.
I think what Representative Newman was leading into is something that has bothered most of us that fell on our sword 3 years ago. We're talking about a plan that basically only applies to 25% of the workforce in the state. When you're saying we need to do this, we're talking about basically, for the most part, and I know I'll be corrected before Monday by anybody in the room that has better numbers, but 25% of the workforce in the state roughly is covered by a defined benefit plan. The other 75% is covered by IRAs, SEPs, doesn't have a retirement program at all, and ultimately, their money is being used as much as public employees' money mm-hmm. for this. Now, they're not paying a state sales tax, they're not paying a state income tax, but to use a round number that was given to me recently, we've saved approximately $200 million since we switched over the plan. Unfunded liability got down, and again, I'll be corrected on this, I'm sure. I believe it got down as low as $7.5 billion. Part of that was off the extraordinary 3 years that we had up until recently in the stock market. The other part was for the money that we did it. Ultimately, the only way we're going to be able to fix the unfunded liability is with GF dollars. We've dumped in $550 or $600 million into it and paid down. We got it down to $7.5 billion roughly. I believe right now it's back up to $10.5 billion to $11 billion. That may have changed in the last couple of weeks. It's probably worse. But ultimately, we're talking about a plan that applies to less than 25% of the workforce in the state. Mm-hmm. And I think it bothers, or not bothers, it has concern for the people that are in that 75%. So, I mean, basically, we're talking about a small, you know, relatively small segment of it. I spent a day talking with my borough, my school district, my two cities on the impact that this was having. And one of the gentlemen that will be speaking after your witness is Larry Simmons, who chaired the ARM board, I think, for basically from its close to its inception up until when he was received a new job and didn't qualify as a member of the board for the finance seat. People that I've talked to have been able, aren't having a problem filling positions. In some of the law enforcement, one law enforcement area, they did it by tweaking the salary range. And, but to the best of my knowledge, all of my public entities have not had a problem. So from that standpoint, I'm looking at, we're spending a tremendous amount of money on a benefit that most of the workforce in the state of Alaska does not have. So I wonder if you could address my concerns.
Well, I would say that we, as the employer, the state of Alaska, we're considering the issues that pertain to the people that work for the state of Alaska, and I would also add that the state employees do not receive Social Security benefit, and that. I'm a private business owner. I've paid into Social Security for years and years, but I understand as a state employee, you do not have that ability. So I think it's just looking at the big picture and trying to provide a retirement that is predictable. And that's, you say that your public employee groups are not speaking to you about the importance of this. But I know I'm hearing.
I'm going to let one of them speak in a few minutes.
I'm hearing from all of my public employee groups, and this is their top priority, and that's why I bring it to you, and that's why I very much appreciate having this dialogue and the ability to have an opportunity to talk about these issues.
But I think I would say I'm speaking for the whole state. I'm speaking for the 75% that aren't.
Correct. I understood that.
And. If I was a tier two and who had just missed the cutoff for tier one, I would probably be as concerned as the tier fours that just missed tier three. We've changed it four times in, typically it's been 10 years except from tier one to tier two, which I think was 20 years, 26 years. And that's been roughly every 10 years. Mm-hmm. We've done it to, number one, for dollars. And number two, to keep ourselves competitive with everything else. If we're the only ones offering it, maybe it's too much. I wish I had an easy answer. SB 141 was the hardest vote I've ever had down here. It's going to be much harder than this one if it gets that far.
Right.
There are several of us in the room that were probably the last vote. Representative Harris and I anguished over it, as did, I'm sure, everybody except Representative Lynn. It's in the room.
I said, go, go, go. Keep defined benefits.
And I understand, Mr. Chairman, I do appreciate that the difficulty that this issue posed for members of the legislature. And that's why I'm not trying to be critical of what happened. I'm trying to be understanding and say that if I was in your shoes, I'm sure I would have, you know, who knows? It's hard to know how you would react, but I mean, given the information that you had, I'm not criticizing your decision. I'm just saying that I do not think, given what we know today, that it was the right thing to do at that time.
Representative Dugan and Representative Seaton, both feel free to ask questions. I know you've, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fortunately for me, anyway, I don't have a dog in this fight. This vote predated my service in the legislature, and I can tell you that I'm happy about that. But It seems to me that if you're attempting to evaluate retirement systems, one of the criteria that you would use is the cost. And what I wanted to ask you was, I think you said in your testimony that you wanted, and I forget exactly what the phrase was, but you wanted some sort of even-handed evaluation of the relative cost of what was the last part of the state system, which was Tier 3, and I think for the teachers it was Tier 2, right?
Yeah.
And then what is now Tier 4 for the state, and I guess Tier 3 for the teachers, right? Is there not any evaluation of that available to us yet?
You know, I've seen percentages, employer percentages, and information that would give us some indication, but I've not seen an in-depth analysis, and I really do think it behooves the state to seek that information. And as we go down this path, I think that'll help us in this decision of whether or not to reopen and to reestablish a defined benefit opportunity.
Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Equally, it would seem to me that what you would want to try to do is to evaluate the employment effects of the change in terms of things like that were mentioned before. Basically, are more people leaving? Are they staying here a shorter period of time? Is it harder to get them to come to work for you? There'd be all of those kinds of questions. And I'm just asking you, as one of the sponsors of the bill, if we can expect to see information on those questions as well. Because, there may be other elements to this too, and certainly the people who had this, sort of walk the gauntlet on the last one might know them. But just looking at it myself, it's a balance between what it's going to cost you and what this system costs you compared to what another system would cost you, and what the employment effects of this system are as compared to the employment effects of another system. And as I say, there might be other ways you would evaluate it as well, but I'm not sure exactly what those would be at this point. Mm-hmm. So, what am I missing here?
I think you're onto the right track there, that there are a number of issues. Some are direct costs and some are indirect costs, and those should all be incorporated into an honest study of what's going on.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean to monopolize things here, but could you define honest for me in that sentence?
Honest. I'm sorry.
I didn't use it.
Accurate. I guess accurate is a better word.
I'd like to make one comment. I'd like to defend the administration. I've gone to the administration probably half a dozen times with questions, and I've got what I consider to be accurate answers. They haven't taken a position. I would agree with Representative Harris on that, but I think that was one of the problems we had a few years ago, is we had an administration that was actively pushing one direction. Well, and I've been pleased with the response I've had off the administration this go around. It was much more consensual than last time.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, I certainly did not mean to disparage the administration at all with that comment. I meant that I would like to see those numbers and that analysis. I think that would be very, very helpful to me, and I know the other members of the legislature, I think, would benefit with that information.
Yeah, the most recent numbers I have are in the packet. It was one-page ledge research document that
from the Buck
was based on numbers from the administration and cited. Representative, I believe Representative Seaton was in front of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also would like to see some of those analyses, because one of the reasons we designed the program, when everybody came to us, it was that they were having trouble filling positions. They couldn't get people for the electrical workers. They couldn't get special education teachers under Tier 3. This bill says, let's go back to a system that people came to us on both sides, the employers and the employees, that said, we're not able to recruit teachers under our current system, which was Tier 3. And so that was one of the problems that we were having, and now we are identifying that we are having problems recruiting and not looking at any relative, what was the problem then and what was the problem now, and just blaming the current system on that, as if we go back to the previous one that had the same problem, it would be cured. And so I think that that would be very helpful to have that portion in there. I was, a couple things that I had a question about. One was, I think the statement was that new employees are the best source of cash flow for retiree payments. Is that what you were saying?
That the rate of return on the investments by the management board, the retirement fund, it currently is about 8.25%. Because the DB plan now is a closed plan, that the expected rate of return is expected to reduce over time to about 6%. The difference in that will be a lot, you know, maybe more than $1 billion, and that will add to the unfunded liability.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I was curious because I hope we weren't talking about going to a charging the current employees to make payments for the like Social Security.
Called a Ponzi scheme, isn't it, Mr. Chairman?
And I guess one of the other questions is about, you know, not having enough analyses. As you remember, I think, Mr. Chairman, we had Mercer, which we had some questions about, so we hired Buck to analyze Mercer, and then Representative Harris or Representative Hawker suggested an alternative method to analyze both Buck and Mercer, and they came out and said the unfunded liability was probably worse than either of them were analyzing. So, I mean, I think at the time we tried all the analyses we could, but, you know, basically we were looking at even growing at 8.25%, we'd have $30 billion to pay scheduled payments of $45.5 billion, which left us at $15.6 billion of scheduled payments. And so I guess, you know, there is some question about how we get there, and if we go back to a system that generates new unfunded liabilities, if we don't have any other way than general funds to generate that money, and that puts hits on future budgets, how do we balance that versus the citizens of the state, you know, the other needs of the citizens of the state instead of just into the retirement system?
Well, the unfunded liability is not a direct function of whether it's a defined contribution or a defined benefit system. It's a direct function of investing the proper amount that is recommended by your actuaries into the retirement plan. And as I said earlier, the rate of return, because the plans are now closed, will also add to the unfunded liability. So, I mean, looking at other examples, I mentioned the example of West Virginia. I think it's very clear that they were compelled to go back to defined benefit because they were trying to deal with the unfunded liability, and in the end, it actually, that was not happening. It was, they were not correcting the unfunded liability. It was getting worse. So I don't think that going back to a defined benefit plan is directly linked with an unfunded liability. You have to be committed to funding it at the proper amount, and then the unfunded liability will not balloon over time. But if you absent that, then it's not a direct issue of whether it's a DC plan or a DB plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so we're clear, you know, when we were looking at the plan and the amount that, you know, stock market performance, those kind of things, that only amounted for 11% of the unfunded liability. The major portion of the unfunded liability came from people living longer than were anticipated.
That's true.
And healthcare costs going higher. I think 56% which left 44% on the retirement side, but 56%, mine, if I recall right, was based on healthcare costs. So, you know, our problem is that a defined benefit problem is exclusively the cause of an unfunded liability. If you have a defined benefit program and you guarantee to pay a certain amount, it doesn't matter how much the costs go up, you on health care, you've said you'll cover the health care. And that creates an unfunded liability in the future because health care costs increase. If you have people living longer, you've guaranteed that you'll make a certain payment every month, every year. They are now living longer, and therefore that defined benefit to the end of their life has created the unfunded liability. So I just, and a defined contribution plan exactly says we are going to contribute a certain amount to you, and that's our liability. So an unfunded liability is exclusively the purview of a defined benefit plan. I mean, that's the very definition, defined benefit, regardless of what that liability is. And a defined contribution is we will deposit so much money in, and that's our liability. As long as we make the deposits up front, that's so I just wanted to clarify that that was the case. I did want to ask one other question, and that was on the ARM board, if I might.
Certainly.
If we stay with the ARM board is structured on a investment advice and expertise in investment, but under the previous plan, the majority of the PERS and TERS board, they were dealing with adjudication of challenges. So how are we going to have an investment board now spend 80% of their time on adjudication of PERS and TERS claims when they are no longer suited because of the qualifications we've put into the ARM board to do that?
Well, first of all, the ARM board, as it's currently structured, is working very well. And I think that was one of the most positive things that came out of SB 141. And I also understand that the Office of the Commissioner is involved in the appeals process of claims before, you know, retirement claims and such. The specifics, you know, I can't answer it beyond that. I can try to get additional information, but as I understand it, the all of the parties are happy with that structure, the ARM board structure, and that is that remains in place with this legislation.
Thank you.
But I'll get additional information on that question.
Representative Booth.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you for your efforts,
and
I hope you realize what kind of a maelstrom you've created here with this investment of time and energy, but a lot of us appreciate it. Would like to talk about some of the things that I hope become part of the conversations, and you touched on a couple of very critical issues. A major component of what we're talking about here is employment, is the employer contribution rate.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early 90s in this state, there were some real changes that were made according to how the state of Alaska contributed to the retirement. And I think it bears witness that we talk about those issues. I agree with Representative Seaton on the definition of what it is that we're facing. But in looking at restructuring of something that we're all looking at as a huge liability here, part of it is in the construction of that kind of retirement. And speaking for my own retirement, the one that allows me to be here at this job, what they have done is they have eliminated the health care side of that liability. And that was a huge component of that defined benefit retirement. So in the discussions that I hope we have over the course of whatever it takes, we're going to have to address those issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in dealing with David Teal last year, one of the biggest things that I learned was that every state in the union has suffered the same kinds of things, especially driven by healthcare costs. And that has been the biggest divider of all of these issues. So that is the one that we really face. And in looking at this for the last couple of years, we've been driven into a social healthcare system in this country where people at 65 are now mandated to go on the government's dole. Mm-hmm. So now part of that has been alleviated. And so, you know, these discussions need to look at where we are today as compared to where we were and how we made ourselves step into a situation where we really need to revamp this entire system. So this is going to be a long endeavor.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to roll up my sleeves along with the chairman, and I appreciate his comments about, you know, the comments you get from your constituency are 180 degrees that I get from mine. But I think it has to do with location and interest. So.
Thank you.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just briefly want to take another bite off the apple here. The other thing that seems to me to be going on when I think about this is that the state has two roles here. It has the role as the payer and a role as the employer. And it may well be that we run into a situation in which our role as the payer and our role as the employer are in conflict. And it would seem to me that what we'd be trying to do, insofar as we're capable of doing it, is to bring those into as much alignment as we can. That doesn't necessarily lead me to one conclusion or the other in the case of the debate between whether we should continue with the, you know, defined contribution plan and, or the defined benefit plan. But it does make me realize I forget where I read this, but somebody once said that the most difficult decisions are not between a right and a wrong, but between two rights. And trying to decide which of those is the more important in this case is going to be pretty difficult. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Do you want to wrap up or do you have more?
Well, I'd like to give an opportunity to Kendra to go over the Buck Consultant memo that you have in your packet. And Ilana, yes, Kendra reminded me that Ilana is still online, and she's calling.
Why don't we take Ilana first?
Okay, great.
Ilana, are you with us?
Yes, hello.
Thank you for both joining us and still being with us. Could you state your name and affiliation for the record? And you've got our undivided attention.
Great. Thank you so much. My name is Ilana Bovey, and I am a policy analyst with the National Institute on Retirement Security.
Well, welcome to Labor and Commerce.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speaking today. And I hope that you find our research helpful. I understand that you've been distributed copies of a PowerPoint presentation that I had emailed over.
Yes.
I think you've all received
yep.
that. Okay, great. So I'm not going to go through the whole thing because I know you wanted me to keep my remarks very brief. But those first few slides there give background information on our mission and our membership. That's just for your reference, so you know who we are. And but for the sake of time, I'd like to get right into the report that I wanted to talk about today. The first study I will discuss is called Pensionomics, Measuring the Economic Impact of State and Local Pension Plans. And so, first of all, why did we do this report in the first place? Well, we wanted to measure the economic footprint of state and local pension plans to actually quantify how much and where pension benefit expenditures make an impact. Also, economists know that DB plans act as an automatic stabilizer for the economy. That is, retirees with stable and secure pensions can keep spending on their basic needs, even in tough economic times like today. So this report gives us a sense of how much of a stabilizing effect state and local pensions may have on the U.S. economy. We all know how important this is today as the economy still can't seem to find its bottom. Another important aspect of this report is that it contains state-by-state data compiled into state fact sheets. Today, I'll talk specifically about our findings in the state of Alaska. So what did we find nationally? Well, we found a large and deep economic footprint. Specifically, in 2006, expenditures made out of state and local pension benefits supported 2.5 million jobs nationwide that paid $92 billion in income. supported $358 billion in economic output throughout the country, $186 billion in value added, and $57 billion in federal, state, and local tax revenue across the country. And so what did we find within Alaska? Well, we found that within Alaska, expenditures made out of these benefits supported 6,270 jobs that paid $358 million in income, $1 billion in economic output throughout the state, and $155 million in federal, state, and local tax revenue. Again, that's all staying within Alaska. Also for Alaska, we found very significant multiplier effects. These are kind of like on a dollar-for-dollar basis. So that for every dollar paid out in benefits in Alaska, $1.25 of total output was generated within the Alaskan economy. And for every dollar contributed by taxpayers to Alaska pensions, $6.35 in economic output was generated. So slide 10, which I'm on now, gives some background information on state and local pensions in Alaska, again, which is there just for your reference. And slide 11 outlines the funding sources of Alaska's pension plan, with some 82% coming from investment income and employee contributions between 1993 and 2006. So you can see by that chart that investment returns really do the majority of the work here, funding 70% of the benefits. So what do we mean by total economic impact? Basically, it's the idea that when a retiree spends their pension check, those purchases have a ripple effect through the economy. That person's spending becomes another person's income, and then that person goes out and spends, and down the line. And again, due to time, I won't go through this in detail, but I think that flowchart on slide 12 explains that concept pretty well. And I'm going to totally skip over slides 13 through 20. These explain the data, methodology, and results of this report in greater detail. I wanted you to have that, again, for your reference in case you had some questions or whatever. But, you know, just for the sake of time, I won't go over those. And so I want to skip right to the conclusion on slide 21. And in conclusion, we can see that state and local pension plans have a large economic footprint throughout the U.S. and within Alaska. These pensions have significant ripple effects, again, as one retiree's spending becomes someone else's income. And these pensions have sizable multipliers, especially considering that upfront investment of a taxpayer dollar. They really do go a long way. And we know that state and local pensions have a critical job in providing a very important source of reliable income for over 7 million retired Americans and 35,000 retired Alaskans. But they also support the macroeconomy. Again, specifically 2.5 million American jobs, over 6,000 Alaskan jobs, $358 billion in national economic activity, and $1 billion in Alaskan economic activity. And these pensions are also automatic stabilizers, again, meaning that retirees can continue to spend on basic needs, whereas maybe people in a 401k plan are contracting their spending. And so that provides an important stimulus during these tough economic times. So now we'll turn to a second NERS report entitled A Better Bang for the Buck. Again, why did we do this study? Well, we frequently hear claims about how defined contribution plans, quote, save money. And we kind of wanted to evaluate this claim. So we asked, how do the costs of delivering the same level of a retirement benefit compare through a DB structure versus a DC structure? So to do this, we worked with a pension actuary and performed what we call an apples-to-apples comparison of the two retirement approaches. And by that we mean, for a given benefit level, for any given benefit level, how much money is it going to take to get you to that level in retirement? And we found that the DB approach is much more cost-effective than the DC approach. For three key reasons, very briefly. The first reason is that DB pension plans pool longevity risks so that, you know, the plan can save to the average life expectancy as opposed to the maximum life expectancy as you would have to in an individual account. Secondly, DB pensions can maintain a better diversified portfolio, so they do not have to move into more conservative investments, you know, as people get older. And DB pension plans achieve better investment returns, and this is something that the literature has found consistently. And so the next two slides, slide 26 and 27, give the cost of each approach, first as a percentage of payroll and then in dollar terms under the modeling we used. And you can see that the DB plan offers a 46% cost savings over the DC plan in our model population. And so slide 28 gives our methodology in this study, which again is there just for your reference. So for this study, again, we find that DB plans have built-in economic efficiencies and therefore provide a better bang for the buck for taxpayers. So we should really be cautious when we hear claims that DC plans save money, because clearly cutting employee benefit levels will always save money, no matter what retirement system you're in. But this study shows that for any given benefit level, the DB plan is the most cost-efficient system. So again, I thank you for inviting me to speak to you today, and if there's time, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Looking at your slide 27 on less balanced performance and lower returns, were you looking at the Alaska system or were you looking at DC plans in general, such as a 401k or a plan that allows the employee to direct their investments instead of...
We were just looking at a general, we kind of developed our own plan in both cases for the DB plan and the DC plan. If you look at that slide 29, we just kind of said, well, we're going to say there are 1,000 female teachers that work for 30 years and their final salary is $50,000. So that could be in any state or municipality in the country, but we just kind of wanted to and we used female teachers just for simplicity, but we just kind of we kind of developed it ourselves. It's a you know, it's just the model we used.
Sure. And follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, because I'm trying to figure out. I mean, we've had a couple of analyses that have looked at a DC plan and looked at the historic lesser return rates. Because we looked at that when the plan was being developed, and in Alaska, you cannot invest your own money and direct your investments. You can only choose between professionally managed accounts that are, you know, have different methodologies, but that they are, it's all professionally managed, and you can't direct your own management portfolio, which has been one of the criteria, as our understanding, that DC plans were much lower. So you looked at just a historic view of all DC plans, not being managed accounts, but being our portfolio managed accounts. Is that correct?
Well, what we did was, I think we used a difference of 80 basis points, so about 0.8% per year. And that was just the lower end of a spectrum that we saw. Like, you know, we kind of did a brief literature review of all the different estimates, and the estimates range from, you know, about 80 basis points to 200 basis points. So we just chose that 80 basis points to give, like, a low range of estimates in the difference between the, you know, the returns in the DB and the DC plan. That's interesting that... the DC accounts in Alaska are professionally managed. It would be interesting to do a study just within Alaska to see what the difference is there, because it may be the case that just because they're professionally managed, they're still not getting a lot of the economies of scale that the DB plan would get. For example, there are investment opportunities that, you know, very large pools of money can get that smaller pools of money cannot get, and that's just the nature of, you know, having a smaller account balance. Certain investment opportunities are not available to individual investors, you know, who aren't millionaires by nature. So I'd be interested to see. The gap is probably much smaller in Alaska, but I would imagine that it might still be there.
Okay. Follow up?
And I'd like to ask one more question. On the DB plan, you show the 12.5% there, but there's no recognition of any unfunded liability because increases over time or increases liability assumed, but contributions being made at the appropriate level at the initial time, but not being adequate when situations change. Am I missing something there, or is this just looking at it if the DB plan was there and if it performed over time the way it was initially designed?
Yes, I guess you could say this is maybe an idealized view of both structures, so that the idealized view of the DC side is that, like, if it's 12.5% of payroll, then no matter who's making those contributions, you know, no matter how it's split up between the employer and the employee, then they're putting that in consistently every month and every year, you know, for the entire employee's career. And then on the DC side, it's kind of idealistic in that, you know, you're going to get that 22.9% investment, you know, in order to get the employee to where they need to be as well, you know, both on the employer side and for the employee to contribute into their own account as well. So, yeah, there's no, we don't talk about an unfunded liability in this study. It's kind of like beyond the scope. It's kind of like an idealized setting, like everyone's going to get to that retirement level, but how much does it take to get them there year to year?
I think that's the big question. Any further questions? Thanks again for waiting for us.
No problem.
Thank you, Alana.
Thanks so much for having me. If you have any other follow-up questions or anything, I'd be happy. You have my contact information. Call us up or send us an email.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
We're at a crossroads right now. We have Larry Simmons, who's not going to be available after today. How long is the sectional, roughly, do you think?
We could go to Larry.
Or we could run late. We could run late tonight, but.
No, why don't we go ahead and, is he available online?
No, he's right behind you.
Oh, yeah.
He's in town.
Sure. Do you want to call him up then, or do you want Kendra to present?
How long do you think, Kendra, roughly, to do the sectional?
I was just going to touch on some brief points. I mean, we
Perfect.
Can skip that, but
go for it.
I want to look at our Buck consultant letter was kind of my most important thing, because if we were talking about different points in different reports, well, that's something that we actually do have and each one of you have that might be a good thing for you to look at. So we can go ahead and skip to that point real quick. I'll let you get there.
Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record again?
Oh, Kendra Kloster, staff for Representative Munoz. So we're looking at the Buck consultant letter that is dated February 12, 2009. And I just wanted to go through this a little bit, because this is the comparing the defined benefit and the defined contribution plans here. What you're looking at on the first chart for the PERS, which is on page one, this is kind of a snapshot of what the boss is putting in. This is what the employer is putting in, and this reflects what the percent for, let's say, a paycheck is coming in for an employee. So looking at the DB plan here for tier three, we're going to look at this as saying 10.95%. And comparing this to the DC plan for the PERS employee is 9.23. So of course we're looking at that DB plan is going to be a little bit higher here. The one point that I'm really wanting to focus on too is now turn over to page two, where we're going to look at the TERS system. DB plan here is 8.96%. So the DB plan here is going to be a little lower than our DC plan that we currently have, which is at 11.4. So comparing these two side by side, when you're looking at PERS and TERS, we have a less than 1% difference here on our pension plan that employers are putting in. So this is coming directly from Buck, and this is something that the administration has gone over with me, and they've incorporated as well, and they agree. So that's just one main point that I wanted you guys to see. As far as the sectional, I kind of figured most of you know what this does. Kathy went through the main points here, and so if you had any questions on that, I'm here to answer them.
Any questions for Kendra? Representative Seaton.
Thanks. I just have one, and that's on the first page there where it's talking about the HAR contribution rate of 3%. Just for clarity, that's not for each. That's 3% of the average of the entire group, so that for a beginning employee it might be 5%, almost 5% of their salary would be contributed into their HRA account, just for clarity, so that it's not 3%, but it depending on where you are in your longevity, because if you're an average employee, it's 3%, but federal law required that everybody was treated exactly the same, but that meant that beginning employees in the initial stage would receive almost 5% of their salary, in their health reimbursement account, which of course is growing over time so that it has a much greater effect. And I just wanted to make sure that we were clear on that 3%. It's not 3% for beginning employee. Thank you.
Any further questions? You'll be able to stay around?
Sure. And again, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to the committee today, and appreciate your indulgence in bringing this bill forward. Thank
you. And the administration is available too for going through this at going through each step by step, which they're really, you know, they're efficient in that. So if you want direct questions for that, I know Pat Shire is available. I saw him around here earlier.
Yeah, I believe Pat's going to be up right after Larry. We're available for questions, or both.
Okay. Thanks again.
Mr. Simmons. I've invited Mr. Simmons because of his past involvement with the ARM board, but I think I could probably let him do a better job of giving his history than what I can do. Although I've known him for 25 years and I have a tremendous amount of confidence in him, and was really pleased when he got appointed to the ARM board.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members, for allowing me to speak today. I am Larry Simmons. I'm the city manager for the city of Soldotna. I've been the city manager for about 8 months or so. Previous to that, I was finance director at the city of Kenai for 12 years. Prior to that, I was 15 years in the finance department at the Kenai Peninsula Borough. As has been mentioned, I was a trustee on the ARM board for 3 years, the first 3 years of its existence. And it grieves me that I'm not on that board now. And the reason that I'm not on that board now is because city manager does not have finance director in the title. And therefore, your legal department determined that I was no longer eligible to be on that board. So I had to resign. And it saddens me greatly because there's been no other professional thing that I've done outside of my regular job that I enjoyed more or worked harder on than I did on the ARM board. I am also, so I think it's fair to say that I have extensive knowledge of PERS and TERS issues. I'm a certified public accountant, and I've got roughly 25 years of local government experience. I want to say that I'm against repealing the pension plans that are commonly known as the DC plans. That's PERS Tier 4 and TERS Tier 3, which were effective July 1, 2006. I will refer to these plans as the DC plan, but I hope you know that in reality these plans are blended plans that have both DC and DB components to them. You've heard about the HRA thing here, and there's other DB components to this plan that you have adopted. I want to say up front also that the city of Soldotna is not having problems hiring nor retaining personnel under the current Tier 4 retirement plan. Since implementation, we have successfully hired several police officers, both inexperienced police officers, some of them look way too young to be police officers, and also experienced people from other states, in fact. We've also hired equipment operators just recently and office personnel. These vacancies were created primarily from retirement. I'd also like to say that unlike the employees of the state of Alaska, Soldotna employees are not only not in Social Security, but they don't have SBS. And I think that if you did a poll of your employees that are in SBS and asked them, which would you rather have, the defined contribution plan, which is SBS, or the defined benefit plan, which is Social Security, most of them would say, I think I'll keep my SBS. I just believe that. It's a tremendous program, one that I've never been able to participate in.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean to interrupt your testimony, but clearly you haven't been looking at your SBS statements lately. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. Everybody's statements look pretty ugly unless you're in cash. One position that we were not able to fill recently was an engineering position. We simply did not set the salary high enough to attract that person. The reason I'm against going back to the full DB plans is that they are too costly, and the total cost, this is the most significant thing, the total cost cannot be known until the last person in the plan dies, let alone when you're making that salary payment for the services that your employee has rendered. Prior to a few years ago, we were all blithely going along thinking that our pension plan was fully funded. Well, it wasn't. They weren't fully funded, and the recent market upheavals have dealt us another staggering blow, the impact of which will not be known in the rate until 2012. The result of these impacts is and may continue to be skyrocketing contribution rates. With the DC plan, the cost is known. That's a significant thing for an employer. The employer pays at one time, at the same time the services are rendered. If we find it difficult to hire employees, we need to raise wages. I have been in favor of the DC plan since the first discussion of it. And my thought always has been and continues to be that if we create a retirement system that's competitive with the private sector, we will probably have to have wages also that are competitive with the private sector. So the answer to the problem of not being able to hire people, in my opinion, is wages. But at least that's a local control decision. It's not the retirement system wagging the whole decision-making process. At June 30, 2007, which is the date of the last actual actuarial valuation, the total unfunded liability for PERS and TERS together was around $7.5 billion, as we've already heard. Since then, investment returns have not met the actuarial assumption of 8.25%. Although we do not have a more current actuarial valuation, I think it is reasonable to predict that the unfunded liability at June 30, 2008, the most recently completed year, will be up, because we had negative investment returns last year of about 3%. That is about 11% below the actuarial assumption of 8.25% positive. Fortunately, we don't see rates going quite like this because the ARM board adopted a smoothing mechanism that recognizes investment gains and losses over a period of 5 years, just like the PERM fund does. This fiscal year, as we've already heard, investment returns are over 20% negative. And if it doesn't turn around, I can absolutely predict that the unfunded liability will be up at June 30, 2009. Now, you won't get your actuarial evaluation for June 30, 2009 until April 2010. So, and then the rates don't kick in until 2012. So there's this long lag time that happens as a result of these investment returns. Obviously, this will put upward pressure on the contribution rates. At June 30, 2007, total assets of PERS and TERS were $15.8 billion. At June 30, 2008, 15.5. You would have hoped that with the high contribution rates that were happening in 2008, which, by the way, for TERS was 54%, you would have hoped that you would have seen assets climbing during that period, but no, they actually declined. As of January 31st, 2009, which is the latest available financial statements, show the market value to be $12.1 billion. That's $3.7 billion down from the last actuarial valuation at June 30, 2007. Now, clearly, assets are going in the wrong direction. Ideally, we would have been making progress on paying down the unfunded liability, but we haven't. I don't, however, want to be critical of the investment team that the state has. They are phenomenal. They are in the top tier frequently, and as you've heard, the whole country is experiencing these problems. It doesn't change the fact that we're having a problem, though.
I believe they did better than the permanent fund did.
They've since I've been affiliated, they've always done better than the permanent fund, and that's not to knock the permanent fund. They had good returns as well, but I think that's a little known fact and one that should be repeated. Thank you. As an employer, I like the DC plan for the certainty of cost that such a plan provides. The employer is responsible to pay the retirement contribution one time only, at the time that the services are rendered. I think that me as a city manager, I put together a budget every year and I say, you know what, it's going to cost $800,000 to plow the streets in Soldotna. Well, if 10 years later, I find out that, oh my goodness, I should have put more into my retirement plan. I should have collected taxes to pay the actual cost of the streets, which was $900,000. Well, that's pretty hard to do. In the private sector, it's impossible to do. Once you sell your Chrysler, you know, you can't go back to the customer 10 years later and say, oh, I should have charged you $26,000, not $25,000. My costs were actually higher. That's why I think it's important to consider the certainty of a DC plan. I don't think the public sector should be different from the private sector. And I think that you'll search hard before you find a private sector employer that offers a DB plan like Tiers 3 PERS and Tiers 2 TERS. Consider carefully, before you make promises to future employees that the residents of Alaska will provide them with guaranteed retirement benefits, the cost of which you cannot possibly know. This is 30 years from now that these people are going to retire. My experience of the last several years tells me that even the experts may not be able to reasonably predict such costs. I've sat through a lot of actuarial valuation explanations, and you know what? One year they say this, and the next year they say something else, and it's just not really very exact science. One of them likes to say it's an art and a science, and it's the art part that really bothers me. Anyway, ask yourself the question, is it right to require future generations of Alaskans to pay the cost increases that seem to inevitably beleaguer defined benefit plans? Is it right to task? I think of myself. I've been in this business 25 years, so I've been earning retirement benefits for 25 years. Take the first day. My children are going to be responsible because we have a $10 billion liability. My children are going to be responsible for paying the cost of those retirement, that retirement benefit that I earned 20 years ago. Personally, I don't think it's right. Major corporations have gone bankrupt due to their inability to fund defined pension plans. I'm very concerned that governments are headed down the same path. I'm very concerned that the city of Soldotna will not be able to continue the service levels that our residents enjoy today if our PERS contribution rates increase any more than they already have. Remember that in 2004, the PERS rate was about 6%. And now the PERS rate is 35%, but fortunately the state of Alaska pays 13% of that, so Soldotna is responsible for 22%. And I suppose if you in this room could guarantee the municipalities that you will never change that 22% rate, then we would have less concern about it, even though 22% is a tall number. But I think that it's entirely possible that if oil prices do not increase and investment returns do not come in the way that you'd like, that you'll be hard-pressed to trade that 22% for the services that Alaskans need. I think that there's a high likelihood that sometime in the next 5 years we'll see a careful consideration of whether 22% is the right number. To me, it seems unwise to change course on our pension plans, especially now when it's abundantly clear that investment returns are volatile and may not produce the returns that our defined benefit plans depend on. Imagine the contribution rates that will be necessary to pay off the unfunded liability in the event that investment returns do not return to normal quickly. Just last year, the TERS rate was 54%. Now, the state paid all but 12.5% of that, so school districts weren't hit real hard with it. But 54%, is it sustainable? Can you say that a DC plan is equal in cost to a DB plan when you got 54% rates to cover the unfunded liability, and that's over the next 25 years? That's not 1 year, that's not 2 years, that's 25 years. The contribution of the state of Alaska and the employer of a teacher, therefore, then making $50,000 was $27,000 to the system. Doesn't seem sustainable to me. I would also ask that you carefully consider whether it's right, in a moral sense, for you to promise new employees benefits that may be impossible to pay 30 to 50 years from now? If the answer to that question in your mind is yes, then I must ask, is it right, in a moral sense, to make such a promise, not knowing what future generations of Alaskans will have to sacrifice in order to pay for that promise? This is a time for conservatism. The private sector has certainly embraced defined contribution plans. You'll be hard-pressed to find one that offers similar plans, as I've also said, to Tiers 2 and 3. Please hold this bill in your committee and let the rest of the United States, the rest of the governments in the United States, catch up to the pioneering and difficult work that the Alaska legislature did when it adopted the blended retirement plans that we have now. This is the fiscally responsible thing to do, and in my opinion, it's the right thing to do. Thank you for letting me speak today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry, I've been a little confused with the fiscal note, and I look on page 2 of the bill where it says the employer shall transmit the contributions calculated under A, which is the actuarially determined employer normal cost for the plan and all contribution required by the former 1425.350 and by 3930.370 for the fiscal year. Do you interpret that the same as I do, is that the full normal and the contributions required under the former defined benefit plan would now fall on back to the communities, back to the employer, or am I misreading what the law would be? Are you familiar with that?
I'm sorry, Mr. Seaton. I'm not able to, through the chair, I'm not really able to interpret that. What I would assume is that employers would be responsible for the normal cost rate and any past service liability that the actuary, well, actually the ARM board sets the rate, and then if the state of Alaska makes on behalf payments. That's what I assumed. I don't know if a close reading, I would hope that a close reading wouldn't be more than that.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'm just that's the way I read the legislation. That's not the way the fiscal note is. The fiscal note's assuming that the liability is 22.5% and 12.5% as we set. But this would be superseding legislation that I believe would bring the unfunded liability costs back to the employers, and maybe we can get some definition on that later. I appreciate it. Can I have one follow?
Certainly.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I did distribute to the committee and to the other folks here. I hope Larry's got it. We were talking about retention rates and on the side that is talking about PERS and TERS retention rates as a percentage. Is this kind of your experience as well, is that under the DB plan, if you see the bottom two sets of boxes there, we had a two-year retention rate of 55% in PERS, and under the DC plan for the 2 years that we've had, full 2 years of DB, see, we had 57%, so we actually had better retention rates. And also under TERS, we went from 59% two-year retention rate under TERS to higher retention rate, 64% now for TERS. Is that kind of how your experience in the Soldotna area? Are you seeing better retention, or do you have enough employees to know?
Well, we have had several new employees, none of which have left. I can say that. I don't recall of any new Tier 4 employee that has maybe there's one who left, not for retirement reasons, but for other reasons.
Do you think, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Simmons, this is one of these points in these committee meetings where I'm going to display the absolute depth of my ignorance here in the hopes that you can enlighten me. Could you explain to me what the unfunded liability is?
Yes, the unfunded liability is the difference between the actuarial value of the assets, which is slightly different than the market value due to that smoothing stuff, but basically it's the difference between the assets that you have on hand to pay for benefits and the calculated liability, which is kind of a present value number, for those benefits when they're due. So the actuary's job is to, really his job is mainly to calculate what that liability is. And then it's just an arithmetic calculation between the assets and the liability. So you're short. Essentially, you've got a liability figure of let's call it $25 billion, and you've got assets available of $15 billion. So you got a $10 billion unfunded liability. And the way that that works, the way that it's paid off, is the actuary, each year that that unfunded liability happens, or if there's an actuarial surplus, that can happen too, they will calculate over a period of 25 years, like a mortgage, what it's going to take, and then they calculate a rate. So currently, I don't have the numbers right in mind, but the normal cost rate, the rate for the benefits that I'm earning today is around 14%, and the difference to 35 is that unfunded liability piece that's going to pay that liability off over 25 years.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, thank you. So the unfunded liability isn't a real number to the extent that it's not what the state's going to pay next year.
No.
Right? It's a sort of based on, I guess, a bunch of assumptions, because more people could drop dead than you think are going to, and the rest of that, right? It's a number based on a bunch of assumptions.
Absolutely.
About what the cost of the retirement plan is going to be to you for this set of beneficiaries at this time. Am I correct in understanding that?
I believe you are. I think, in fact, okay. Every single individual person is looked at.
So it's an attempt to do something that you said earlier couldn't be done, which is to know the cost of the plan, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
It's an attempt to do that. That's correct.
Okay. If I might, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up?
There's just a couple more points that you raised in your testimony that I want to make sure that I understood. You had said that you don't think that the public sector should be different from the private sector. There's been some discussion about the question of whether or not offering a defined benefit retirement plan is an effective way to keep people working for the state of Alaska who might otherwise make more money someplace else. So if we're not going to do that, would you then advocate that what we're going to have to do is sort of pay market rate for the people that we've got working for the state?
Like I said, I think that if we have a market type of retirement system, it's very, very likely that we will also have to have a market type of salary.
Yeah.
And the only difference that, in my experience locally, the only difference then between the private sector and us now is kind of the everyday benefits that the public sector health benefits that the public sector gets that the private sector in many cases does not. So, but I think your point is right on.
Okay. And just one more thing. This is an observation rather than a question. If, in fact, future generations of Alaskans have to pay anything at all for retirement plans, they're going to be different than the current generation of Alaskans, at least at this point. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman.
Representative Booth, followed by Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Appreciate you coming forth and coming down here and clearing up some of these rather complex issues. Through the chair, do you have personal history with the process that the state of Alaska used in their actuarial process for the last 15 years? How did the state of Alaska, up until we changed SB 141, how did it actually work in the state of Alaska that they looked at the employer contributions and the actuarial process by which our presenter's retirement worked?
My involvement, I mean, for many years, frankly, I ignored the whole actuarial process altogether because our rates were low and no, I thought everything was good. I got involved in about 2003 after the 2002 big bang when the unfunded liability went through the roof. All I can say is that the process has been similar forever. Mercer was the consultant for 25 years, and the process was similar. They would look at all of the liabilities for each individual person and come up with this liability number and compare that to assets, and a lot of times it was good. It was really good. We were 106% funded at some point. So what has happened is that people begin to question some of those assumptions, and so a review actuary was hired, and that review actuary said, well, guess what? Mercer's assumptions weren't right, and so, you know, you need to make these adjustments, all of which, or most all of which, cost more money. And then we had another experience rating done by Buck in 2005. And again, to few people's surprise, they found that, it's going to cost you more. There has been one circumstance where they actually found out that health care costs weren't rising as quickly as they had previously thought, and there was an actual aerial gain at the end of 2007. So there's this extensive review that happens. It's a very expensive and extensive review that Buck does.
I'll add something to that. Part of it was Mercer was using an old actuarial table on life expectancy, and that people were living a lot longer than what we were budgeting for. Secondly, the amount of contribution that was being made into the unfunded liability was less than what it should have been, and there were a number of questions on why, but I don't think Mercer was totally liable for that portion, if I'm not mistaken. I think there were some political judgments made on how much we could fund at various points in time, so I don't think we can lay the whole thing off on Mercer, but I think there was enough damage done by that firm. I believe we're in litigation with them at this point in time. I think that's common knowledge. But follow up. New question?
No. This is exactly on point. I'm here because of a defined benefit contribution. I couldn't afford this job without it. Part of what the expenses and so forth that I caretake for, getting back and forth, setting up another household, I have to offset from that. The difference between the mechanism by which that facility works and the state is that they have 11 or 12 actuarial agencies. Every 3 months, they look at their progress. And the ones that don't perform are gone. So they don't have one, they have several, and they have a lineup of replacements. And they don't look at a retirement 2 years in arrears or 1 year in advance. They look at it 100 years out, and that's the difference. So I don't look at it as a change in the way that we did things then. I look at it as a change in what happened with SB 141 myself. So it's a different purview of the way that we look at things. And when you're looking at guarantees in budgets, let's take a look at your snow plowing budget as an example. It's a function of the weather.
It certainly is.
Do you control that?
No, I don't.
There's no guarantees in this life. None. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynn.
You stole a bit of my thunder. No, actually, according to the Mercer actuarial tables, I'm already dead.
We were wondering about that.
And my colleague left was wondering about that. He keeps feeling my pulse, you know, and I thought there was some other reason earlier. You said that municipalities should pay private wages, right? That would be way out of this. Why do you suppose municipalities don't pay the same wage that a private party would?
Well, there's numerous reasons why. One of them is other benefits. So you put the whole package together you don't have to pay as much in wages because there's other components of the package that are better than the private sector. For example, on our operators, we can typically pay operators less money because our operators get paid that amount 12 months a year, whereas if they're working in construction, they might not get 12 months a year, or they have to move all over the country. So those, you know, that would be one example of why.
Yeah, I understand that. I was in the military. They had retired military, thank you. I put up a lot of guff. One of the reasons is I had defined benefits. I was in another combat zone. I was teaching, and and they had defined benefits. That's why I put up with some of my students, and why I put up with some of the parents and some of the staff, as far as that goes. So it is a total package there. But I suppose that, you know, if you don't pay as much as private sectors do, and you probably don't do that because you can't afford to do it. So are you picking your poison here? Wage, salary versus a retirement package?
I think you are, sir. But the difference, in my opinion, although it may be slight, is that you have a local control issue. The council of the city of Soldotna can decide if they are going to pay $20 an hour or $25 an hour. They cannot decide. They have no seat at the table whether they're going to pay 22% on their PERS or 40 or 54. So it's a local control question.
I see. And
it's important, I think.
As are wages and salary, local control.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I was curious, when we were dealing with the run-up in contribution rates, we had a number of cities, when we were under the DB full plan, had a number of cities that were going to pull out of the program. They were basically going to be bankrupt and pulling out. Do you have any idea of whether we would be in those same situations again if we went back to the Tier 3 defined benefit plan with the contributions as they were scheduled before? Do you think we'd still be in those same situations with municipalities pulling out of the plan or just declaring themselves bankrupt and if they had to have that 54% contribution rate on city employees?
Well, I think that it is a function of the local government's ability to pay. And as those rates climb and takes up a larger and larger share of their available resources that are normally intended to provide services, then they get to the place where they just say, well, I can't afford this. I'm not going to do it. I can't do it. And it could happen as a result of whether we go back or whether we don't. If we have extremely poor investment returns, or if you legislators decide that, you know what, it'd really be nice if we gave people a few more benefits, and that unfunded liability goes right straight through the roof and so does the rate, that could happen regardless of what you do with the DC plan, because we've got this legacy DB plan out there that will be affected by those decisions and that investment returns. I personally believe that we take greater risk of that happening with these 11,000 people that are now under the DC plan. I personally think that the employer, who is clearly taking on all the risk, is most likely going to pay more for that DB plan than the DC plan. And not only that, it could be 15, 20 years from now when you have to pay that. That's the thing that really bothers me about it. I hear folks say, well, you know, DB, DC, it's same, cost same. Well, and how come we have 54% rates? And who can guarantee that 25 years from now we won't have 54% rates again?
Follow up?
A different question.
Sure.
And that was, there are several sections in the bill, such as in Section 2, on Page 2, Section 6, where we're talking about the post-retirement adjustments. And in the current law, it is that those post-retirement extraordinary cost of living adjustments don't take place unless the plan is funded at 105%. If we would remove that constraint so that even if we were in an unfunded level like we are now, that we would be required to make those additional, beyond the automatic cost of living, but the additional post-retirement cost of living adjustments. Do you have any idea, being a member, past member of the ARM board, what kind of a liability that that would create on the system?
It would depend entirely upon the percentage increase and the cumulative effect of those percentage increases over time, what that impact would be. But clearly, every time, frankly, every time a municipality or a school district, like, say, Anchorage, increases teacher salaries more than the actuarial assumption, that unfunded liability goes up as a result. And in a cost share plan, everybody in the system gets to share in the cost of that. That's the beauty and also the curse of it, I'd say. So, you know, I don't know the direct answer, but as you increase wages above what the actuarial assumption is, then it will have a negative effect on the unfunded liability.
Follow up. So that post-retirement cost of living adjustment that is basically additional cost of living adjustments above the automatic for...
I use the term wages, but it's payouts.
It's really payouts, right. Yeah. Then that would build each year depending upon what the cost of living was. If the cost of living is more than the automatic adjustment, and that goes to people outside the state of Alaska, right? All the retirees that are living outside, if the cost of living in the community where they're living is the same as Anchorage.
I think that was that 10% deal, and somebody else could correct me, but I thought we won that one, but I'm not positive. But
thanks, Chair.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, I'm going to take advantage of the fact you're here and know something about this to pick your brain. But to revert to the question of the unfunded liability for a second, the components of that, I take it, are that costs went up higher than people thought. Nobody thought that medical costs were going to continue to go up. At one point, somebody once said, well, they can't do that. They'll take up the entire gross national product at that rate, and they still went up at that rate. So you had costs going up in sort of unpredictable ways. The second component was that we weren't putting enough money into the system to correct for that, or, you know, maybe just to keep things going even if they hadn't gone up, I don't know. And the third is that the investments, the money that we put in, the investments that they were put in didn't perform the way we had hoped, right? Are there any other elements of that I missed there?
I think you've got the broad categories,
okay,
sir, but maybe I could fill in a little bit of the gaps. I wrote a couple of things. So it falls into several broad areas. Investment losses, which you've named. Actuarial assumption changes, which are huge. That could be all the way from how long people live to what health insurance is going to cost, how many males and females do we have in the program, how many children, it's extensive. So, and then differing actual experience from those assumptions. You have the assumption, and when you make a change in the assumption, it's huge because it affects everything. And then you also have the actual experience different, like people living longer than expected. Finally, and the one that I really want to impress on you folks is the thing that has just an absolutely huge impact on this is when you get kind of up there, let's say that 5 years from now, by some miracle, we're 105% funded. You will be getting a great deal of pressure to increase benefits because we've got the money to pay for it. When you do that, it has a huge impact. So that's another total unknown as an employer at the city of Soldotna.
Paul?
If I might, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. But I just wanted to follow this up. So in response to that, we went to a different system. And what we've really done, in addition to everything else we've talked about, is we've shifted risk, right? Because if the risk is that the costs go up, the cost for medical or retirement and buy your trailer in Florida, whatever it is, that risk now falls on the individual rather than on the state. And that if the investments don't perform, that risk now falls on the individual instead of the state as well. I guess the whole not enough money put in is still our problem, right? I mean, whether how much we're going to fund the existing system is still our problem. Although it for these people, it's not, because we're not, you know, that's already decided. We're going to give you X amount of your salary, and you're going to do with that what you will. So essentially, again, we come to the question, I think, of being the difference between being the payer and being the employer. Because it seems reasonable to me that if the state were bearing those risks, it would be easier to hire and retain people than it is in a situation in which you're expecting them to shoulder that risk, all other things being equal. Is that?
I believe you're absolutely right.
Okay,
and
I
said that at a candidate forum here a while back. And as a city manager, I would much rather be out here recruiting with this gold-plated retirement plan. But the question is, who's going to pay for it?
Right. As I said before, Mr. Chairman, there is that difference that because we're both here. We're the payer and the employer. And so you've got sort of competing goals there, I think, at this point. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
I guess following up on Representative Dugan's question there, I'm trying to figure out whether at some point what you offer is known to an employee and they take a job or they don't take a job. And if you don't offer enough to be competitive for that person to make an individual decision that they want to work for you, that your hours of operation, your full year-round employment, you're not having to leave home to go up on the North Slope for a job or something. So if you were offering that and a person comes and decides, yes, they want a job with you, do you feel that you need to offer something more for I guess your testimony has been that's what you want to do. You don't want to be saying that you want to put the liability on future city councils to pay for the folks that you hired because of an unfunded liability. You want to have them make the employees make that decision whether that's adequate for them or not to become an employee. Is that what I'm?
Yes. I mean, I think it's incumbent upon the employer to put together a pay and benefits package that is marketable. Otherwise, like where we are right now, I mean, we were offering some $50,000 for an engineering position. Not going to happen. So, you know, if we want to hire an engineer, we're going to have to raise that salary level. That's just all there is to it. And so I think it's incumbent on the employer to do that. And my whole point that I'm trying to make here is that the DC plan allows certainty. The DB plan guarantees uncertainty.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thanks again, Larry.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much.
I
appreciate
it very much. And should you have any questions for me at any time, you can contact me at the City of Soldotna.
That's what you're looking at.
I think the plan at this point in time is to bring the administration in Monday afternoon before we start public testimony. And if anybody has any questions, they can work on them between now and Monday, and then we'll go into public testimony at that point in time. And with that, we're adjourned.
Thank you.